Hi, it's Mike Pesca, host of The Gist. Before the show proper today, I want to talk to you for a second about Slate Plus. A lot of you have signed up for Slate Plus since the election. It really is the best way to keep Slate and The Gist covering politics and the upcoming Trump presidency without fear or favor. The qualities that you have come to value in The Gist, I hope, qualities like curiosity, probing questions, willingness to question any doctrine, and standing up to who's ever in power, they seem to me more important now than they've ever been. If you value the importance of independent journalism, please consider a Slate Plus membership. We need your help to do it. If you are already a member, thank you. And to find out more, go to slate.com/gistplus.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, November 22nd, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Donald Trump assembled the press, or at least anchormen, anchorwomen, anchor people and executives, and yelled at them. I think that conversation with his advisors before the meeting went like this. Wait, if it's off the record, how's this work? I could say anything? That's right, sir. And they can't say anything about what I said? That's right, sir. So it's sort of like when I say to my wife, now don't be mad at me, but she actually can't be mad at me. That's right, sir. All right, let's do this off the record. So that went down. Then he went to the New York Times. It was supposed to be off the record. Then it was on the record. Then the meeting was off. But for the record, the meeting was on. Not much news was broken. In fact, the only news really that Trump broke was via a YouTube video where he reiterated some things he was going to do. But on the subject of regulation, he said this.
On regulation, I will formulate a rule which says that for every one new regulation, two old regulations must be eliminated. So important.
So important. I hadn't heard that before. For every new regulation that passed, two existing regulations would have to drop off. I have a feeling that one of the regulations he's looking at is the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. No person holding any office of profit or trust shall, without the consent of Congress, accept a present emolient office or title from a king, prince, or foreign state. Because right now, second he's sworn in, unless he does something, he is in violation of the Emoluments Clause. Emoluments from the Latin word meaning to pay the grinder. But what are the regulations that could drop away? So I found a list of laws, regulations that the president, new President Trump, might consider doing away with. It's called Dumb Laws. I think a lot of them are made up. But dumblaws.com actually links to actual laws that we could consider doing away with. Regulations like in Alabama, the anti-bear baiting regulation. Why? That could go, I think, right? People with venereal disease can't get married in Nebraska. That could go. We could live without that. In Rhode Island, you can't bite off anyone else's leg, or rather, you can. Here's the law. Every person who shall voluntarily, maliciously, or purposefully put out an eye, slit the nose, ear, lip, or cut off, bite off, or disable any limb shall be imprisoned not exceeding 20 years. So we could do away with that regulation, you know, lower the penalty for biting off someone's leg. In Georgia, you can't live on a boat for more than 30 days in a calendar year. So there's, if you're very crafty, you could live on a craft starting maybe December 2nd, live all the way to January 30th, not in violation of the law. And in New Hampshire, you can't take seaweed off the beach. If any person shall carry away or collect for the purpose of carrying away any seaweed or rockweed from the seashore between daylight in the evening and daylight in the morning, he shall be guilty of a violation. So we could do away with that. Those are some of the regulations that could be on the chopping block to get some new regulations passed. Got to be two for one, remember. On the show today, I spiel about a crazy country, but it's not this one. Look north. But first, a former Breitbart staffer, still a conservative thinker and commentator and talk show host, is here to talk about Breitbart and his former employer, Steve Bannon. It's Ben Shapiro. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, We gather around the defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we quell. To drive the defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Ben Shapiro is a conservative columnist and talk show host, and to give you the flavor of conservatism that he brandishes, he did not write A Child's Treasury of Political Comedy. Among his books are Bullies, How the Left's Culture of Fear and Intimidation Silences America, The People versus Barack Obama, The Criminal Case Against the Obama Administration. You get the point. He's been churning them out since he was about 17 or 18. Now, I wanted to have Ben on because, A, he's a fascinating talker, and I disagree with, 85% of the things he says, but I like to hear him say it. But also, he has a direct connection to Breitbart. He used to work for Breitbart. So who better to ask what it really means and what Steve Bannon really means for this country? Hello, Ben. Thanks for joining us.
Doing well. How are you?
I'm well. So I'll ask it this way. Is Steve Bannon an anti-Semite, would you say?
No, I have no evidence that Steve's an anti-Semite. I think Steve's a very, very power-hungry dude who's willing to use anybody and anything in order to get ahead, and that includes making common cause with the racist anti-Semitic alt-right.
Is that anti-Semitism?
I want to be careful about attributing personal anti-Semitism to him. I will say that it is appeasement of anti-Semitism, which in my book is certainly not a good thing.
Right. So what you're saying is whatever he has in his heart, and you haven't seen anything, he countenances it for either political or media gain.
He certainly did with the alt-right, for sure. And that doesn't mean that Breitbart itself, its coverage has been anti-Israel. It hasn't been. It's a very right-wing site when it comes to Israel. It also doesn't mean that the Jews who work there, like Joel Pollack, for example, have been discriminated against, because, you know, they'll say they haven't, and I wasn't when I was working there. What it does mean is that he allowed the site to be taken over and used by a bunch of alt-right people who are not fond of Jews, are not fond of minorities.
Now, let us talk about when you say he allowed it to be taken over. Is this basically the comment section? He doesn't do any policing of that. I have heard him talk about how important it was to let the comments bubble up and sort of drive the direction of the site. Is that mainly what you're talking about?
I'm talking about that. I'm also talking about the relationship that he's had with some of the sort of popularizers of the alt-right, people who wouldn't consider themselves overtly alt-right, but have made a big deal out of providing sort of popular appeal to it. People like Milo Yiannopoulos, Alan Bakery, the folks in sort of what they call the meme team over there who traffic in sort of alt-rightness. And for folks who don't know what the alt-right is, it might be worthwhile to just sort of start at the beginning and talk about what the alt-right is, because there are a lot of these various definitions floating around, nearly all of which are wrong. So basically, the alt-right is a group of thinkers who believe that Western civilization is inseparable from European ethnicity, which is racist, obviously. It's people who believe that if Western civilization were to take in too many people of different colors and different ethnicities and different religions, then that would necessarily involve the interior collapse of Western civilization. As you may notice, this has nothing to do with the Constitution. It has nothing to do with the Declaration of Independence. It has nothing to do actually with Western civilization. The whole principle of Western civilization is that civilized values can inure to anybody, that anybody can involve themselves in civilized values. That's not what the alt-right believes. At least its leading thinkers, people like Richard Spencer and Jared Taylor and Vox Day, you know, those kind of folks will openly acknowledge that this is their thought process.
Now, let me interrupt you and just say that Richard Spencer was just in a big alt-right conference, and to put a fine point on it, you know, how close is it to Nazism? His speech ended with a bunch of arm salutes, people yelling Sieg Heil, and him winking and quoting in the original German and criticizing the press using a Nazi phrase.
Yeah, they're not good people. I think that's fair to say. What the alt-right is trying to do, and what they've been trying to do now ever since Trump came to prominence, is they've been doing a couple of things. One is they've been broadening the definition of alt-right. I just wrote this piece for National Review for their print edition this week. They've been trying to broaden the definition of alt-right so they can suck people into believing they're alt-right, even though they don't embrace the central tenets of the alt-right. So they'll say things like, well, if you just don't like Paul Ryan, that means you're alt-right. Or if you just like memes, that means that you're alt-right. Or if you think that the Republicans are too weak-kneed, that means you're alt-right. No, that doesn't mean that you're all right. It means that you're not an establishment Republican. You know, I'm not a big Paul Ryan fan per se, but that doesn't make me all right. I'm their number one target, according to the ADL this year. So they've tried to broaden the definition so that they can suck people into believing they're all right and then make themselves seem indispensable by saying, look at all these all right people. They're all out here. And if the Republican Party pushes them to the side, then they're going to pay an electoral price for that. And then you have people winking and nodding at them because they think they're an important constituency. So it's a couple step process. And glomming onto Trump has been part of that because Trump, I don't think, is alt-right. I don't think that Trump is particularly racist. I think he's an ignoramus. But I think that more than anything, Donald Trump is willing to pay heed to and wink at anybody who provides him even a shred of good coverage. So if the alt-right, which worships at the altar of Trump, if they provide him good coverage, he's willing to wink and nod at them and not rip them.
How much does, from what you've seen, how much does Steve Bannon agree with, subscribe to those central notions of European centrism? And maybe the other question is, at what point will he stop?
Well, I mean, I think that Steve will stop if it becomes politically convenient for him to stop. Steve is not a deeply principled guy on politics. It's not like he's coming in with this ramrod agenda. He's coming in and he's talking about big government spending, right? He's talking about trillion-dollar infrastructure packages. If you had to peg Steve down on ideology or philosophy, you'd say he's sort of like a European far-right leader. He's more like Marine Le Pen or Nigel Farage than he is like a constitutional conservative. He doesn't like constitutional conservatism. He thinks that it's an obstacle in the way of building this new, you know, sort of third way movement, this independent political movement that is focused on heavy spending, even some redistribution inside the country, but closed borders and tariffs for everybody outside, right? He calls himself an economic nationalist. They say, are you a white nationalist? He says, no, I'm an economic nationalist. That means heavy tariffs. It means closed borders. He's very anti-immigration. And then when he's asked about white nationalism, you know, and its effect in sort of the far right in Europe, he says, well, I think that'll come out in the wash, right? That'll sort of, you know, fade away as time goes on and they're legitimized. Yeah, I don't think so. I've never seen a bad movement or a bad person yet given power and they become better people.
So you think that Bannon is using the alt-right to get his agenda passed, but do you think the alt-right thinks they're using Bannon to get its agenda through white nationalism?
Yes, and that's why, and they'll say it openly, right? They'll say Bannon isn't one of us, Breitbart isn't us, Trump isn't one of us, but they're the most useful tool we've ever found.
And they're not doing that just to detract attention from the media to throw off the scent. They really don't think that Trump is one of them, but he's a useful idiot.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that they think, I don't think that they sit around thinking Donald Trump reads Jared Taylor. I mean, I don't think they think Donald Trump reads books, right? I think that they think that Donald Trump has positions. Those positions are sufficiently warm toward their positions. He's not throwing them out of the tent. And because he won't throw them out of the tent, that makes him their best ally.
Do you think that Bannon is, obviously you think he's wrong morally to play footsie with this group. Do you think it's wrong politically, ultimately?
I mean, ultimately, I think it's wrong politically because I think that everybody is taking the wrong lessons right and left away from this election cycle. I think on the right, people are taking it like Trump won this big, broad victory. Trump lost the popular vote by over a million votes, and he won by very, very narrow margins in places like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Florida. And the fact is that when all is said and done, the groups that are growing demographically in the United States are minorities, women, young people. Millennials will be 40% of the voting population in 2020. And so if you're banking on this kind of ever shrinking group, the alt-right, in order to put you over the top, that seems to me like bad politics. It's alienating politics. It's not something that's going to help. By the same token, I think that the left is making a huge mistake by labeling everybody on the right alt-right, because what they're doing is they're pushing people into the arms of the alt-right. You call people racist enough, and they begin to think, okay, well, who's not calling me racist? I'll side with that guy. So the worst thing the left can do is to continue to suggest that everyone who backed Trump was a racist, sexist, bigot, homophobe, everyone's evil, everyone's terrible. What they really should be doing is they should be saying, look, we understand we lost. One of the reasons that we lost is because Hillary Clinton was a uniquely terrible candidate. She really was. And because of that, we're not trying to throw you guys out of the tent. We think it was a bad choice to choose Trump, but we would sort of appeal to the better angels of your nature that if we think he's divisive as time goes on, that you recognize that he's being divisive. And I think separating off Trump and the alt-right, both of whom are not the same, but separating those off from the general population, not to give advice to people who I hope lose politically, but I think it's a big mistake to have the left, you know, pushing the notion that they're just going to double down on sort of the Obama coalition and tell everybody else to go screw.
When you were at Breitbart, how much did you look around and how much did what you see bothered you before you quit? How much was it weighing on you?
Well, I mean, the kind of Trump move bothered me because it looked to me like a sellout of any sort of conservative principle on behalf of a guy who Andrew Breitbart rightly called in 2011 when I was wrong about Trump. He was rightly calling Trump a clown in 2011. So, yeah. You know, that's it. So I thought that that was disturbing. I didn't follow the comment section too much because you guys know from being online, following comment sections is a quick way to the asylum. So I really didn't spend a lot of time, you know, messing around in the comments, if any. I sort of heard the rumors that the comment sections had become an alt-right cesspool, but I didn't pay attention to it too much. The real obvious shift to me in terms of content came after I left, because it seems to me that I left at the beginning of I think it was mid-March. I declared that I was never Trump on Breitbart, actually. And then 3 weeks later was the Michelle Fields incident. And I left over that.
That was the reporter who was grabbed by Corey Lewandowski in Florida. Yeah. And she was a Breitbart reporter, and Breitbart did not stand by her at all.
Not only did they not stand by her, they undercut her, right? They ran a piece suggesting that it never could have happened the way that she said it happened. And then they still have columnists at their website who claim that the whole thing was a hoax set up by me and Michelle, right? And Ben Terrace from The Washington Post. We got together in a dark room and decided to come up with the worst conspiracy in human history. This kind of stuff is crap, obviously. But to me, the major public move in favor of the alt-right came after I left. And I think, you know, not to be self-centered, but I think part of it probably had to do with the fact that I was one of the biggest name writers on the site, just in terms of social media following. In terms of pure social media following, I was the biggest name writer at the site. And after I left, they looked around at their staff and they said, okay, who can we sort of elevate? And then the next biggest name on the list was Yiannopoulos. And so 2 weeks later, they come out with that alt-right piece glorifying Richard Spencer and such.
What's your relationship? What was your relationship with Milo Yiannopoulos then, and what is it now?
I never had a relationship with Milo. I mean, we sort of would joke around with each other online. I thought that he was kind of he's a provocateur. So like all provocateurs, he did some stuff that was funny and some stuff I thought that was over the top. But I thought that he was doing some stuff that was you know, interesting, if over the top. And then there was sort of a breaking point where he said the Constitution and conservatism were done and it was going to be replaced by this new rising alt-right movement that didn't care about the Constitution. You're cucks, you're losers, all the rest of this stuff. And then it gradually got worse to the point where when my kid was born in May, my second kid was born in May, Milo, who pretends that he's not alt-right, he sent a tweet at me with a picture of a black kid. Right, because the way that this works is that if you are not alt-right, if you're an anti-Trump, then according to the alt-right, you must be what they call a cuck. For those who don't follow this sort of stuff, because you have two brain cells to rub together, cuck, according to the alt-right, means that you're a white person who wants to watch his wife have sex with a black man, right? Because you're poisoning the racial stock of the United States just so you want your own racial stock, quote-unquote, poisoned. I always found the whole thing bewildering. I'm not interested in my wife having sex with a man of any race. I'm not sure why a black guy would be significantly worse just overall. It seems pretty terrible all the way through.
Yeah, that's a little nuance I hadn't really thought of. Like, they'd be okay with the white man having sex with their wife. Yeah, again, one of those not too well thought out aspects. Yeah.
But as long as he's a pure Aryan stupping your wife, then you're fine. But the whole thing is, you know, that's asinine. But he was, you know, he tweeted a picture of a black baby at me on the day that my son was born because I'm a cuck, because I didn't back Trump. As soon as Milo was banned from Twitter, by the way, I don't favor bans on Twitter just generally. Twitter's a private company. Yeah. They can do what they want, but I don't like people getting banned on Twitter because I don't like people, you know, unless there's active harassment, I think it's, you know, dangerous territory. But I can say this, when Milo was thrown off of Twitter, 70% of the anti-Semitism in my Twitter feed disappeared immediately.
The last question is, and this is the big debate, if one wants to oppose what one perceives as some of the possible excesses of the Trump presidency. And I know you've talked about on your show that there's a possibility that he could wind up passing an agenda that you really would like. And I also know that just the angst of liberals delights you to some degree. But what is the best way, knowing what you know about Bannon and Breitbart and the alt-right, what's the best way to oppose those aspects of the Trump presidency that I'm certain almost all the listeners of my show would want to oppose?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first thing to understand is that you're really going to have to target your criticism. I think one of the big critiques that people didn't get, and I think this is why the media blew a lot of credibility in 2016, they blew a lot of credibility in 2012. When you say that I find joy in the suffering of the left, that's only true to the extent that you know, I think that the left would have had some of the same reaction if this had been Mitt Romney winning in 2012. The part where it's unique to Trump, I opposed Trump in the primaries and in the general. I opposed Hillary and Trump. Neither of them met my standard for a human being who should be president of the United States. So you're not talking to somebody who's a major Trump sycophant here. I understand why people are concerned about Trump being president. I'm concerned about Trump being president. So, you know, all of that being the case, I think that it's up to everybody to hold him accountable. But if you're asking what's going to impact policy, as I said to Charles Blow on CNN yesterday, please do not turn everything up to 11. I mean, everybody's going deaf. If you're all going to go nuts over a Hamilton tweet, wait until he's using the White House to do business for Trump Inc. Right? I mean, like, why don't you focus on the things where look at what his people want. And I'm not talking about the alt-right. The alt-right's going to back him no matter what. I'm talking about, the traditional Republican voter who wants to see him do certain things. Watch where he commits a heresy and then say, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot and this were Obama, you'd be ticked. And then I actually did that today on my podcast. I actually brought a physical shoe into the studio and I said, look, this is going to be a new thing. We're going to play shoe on the other foot. So, for example, if Barack Obama went to an event, were booed, and then started tweeting about how terrible the event was and how all the people should shut up and apologize, you'd be ticked. You know, it wouldn't mean that he was censoring anything, but you'd be ticked and you'd have a right to be ticked. And the same thing is true for some of the Trump business reports, right? I mean, there's a report today that may or may not be verified. We're still finding out about him trying to hit up the president of Argentina for a special favor on Trump Tower. I don't know if that's true or not, but we do know, according to the Washington Post, that Trump hotel representatives have been telling ambassadors to use Trump hotels when they come to town. Mm-hmm. That's a serious conflict, obviously. And I think that the more the left focuses on the things that are actually serious, regardless of your politics, like corruption, like policies that are self-directed, I mean, that kind of stuff, I think, will have more of an impact than just going around shouting racist, racist, racist. Because I think one of the big problems here is that if you called Mitt Romney a racist in 2012, it's as Bill Maher said, if you turned it all the way up to 11 for Mitt Romney, it's very difficult for people to hear you when you turn it up to 12 for Trump.
All right. Ben Shapiro of The Ben Shapiro Show. Thank you, Ben.
Hey, thanks a lot. Be well.
And now the spiel. You know, things are pretty crazy here in the U.S., but there is a place very much like us, but more northern, a little less crazy. Actually, just as crazy, but crazy in the shake your head, we're all on this wacky blue marble together kind of way. It's not false news. It's not alt-right. It's not false flags. It's not emoluments crazy. It's Canada crazy. And therefore, it's time for Crazy Canadian News. Chris.
Crazy Canada news every day. Crazy Canada news every way.
Labatt, the Canadian brewer, now actually owned by an international conglomerate, is discontinuing a retirement perk that it had offered employees. It's not healthcare. They're Canadian. They get their healthcare for free. So once you got your healthcare covered, what does a Canadian really need? Beer. The beverage maker offered employees a lifetime supply of beer, or they did before their stingy cutbacks. Perhaps they realized that the cumulative effect of a lifetime of beer might actually wind up undercutting the ability to have national health care. The amount of beer depended on where you live. So some Labatt employees in Western Canada got a free case every week, where in London, Ontario, it was a case every other week. Now, retirees will still get some beer, perhaps a six-pack a week, which, said Glenn Hubbard of Saskatoon, that's great. Now, what do I drink on Tuesday? Of course, in Canada, they drink to celebrate. They drink to forget, sometimes to forget that smell wafting over the western prairies. In Canada, the wind howls a little fiercer. The huskies bark a little deeper. And some say you can taste it in the beer, smell it in the breeze, or hear it in Parliament. When MP Michelle Rempel said this.
Why isn't the government talking about how to retain skilled labor? Why isn't the infrastructure minister talking about how to implement infrastructure funds and get construction workers back to work in Alberta? Why does this government treat Alberta like a fart in the room that nobody wants to talk about or acknowledge?
Why? Why indeed? Could it be because the motto of Alberta is fartus et liber, strong and free? Yes, I know some people pronounce that first word fortis, but I think the original Latin, it's more of a fartus. Although an odd smell in Alberta seems to be a perennial Alberta story. This was local Edmonton, Alberta news from 2 years ago.
It stinks. A strong sewer smell in a West Edmonton neighborhood is so bad, people say it's been waking them up at night.
And in 2013, the Edmonton Journal ran the banner headline, "Why Does Edmonton Smell Like Poop?" And I found this, let's call it this report. It's just a woman who reads the Edmonton Journal aloud on her YouTube channel.
Many Edmontonians took to Twitter on Tuesday to complain about a stinky smell blanketing the city.
But there's a big difference between the smell of poo, which is written in the press, and the evocation of fart on the floor of Parliament. Sorry, did I say fart? I probably shouldn't even be saying the word because Green Party leader Elizabeth May may take offense.
Interrupt my friend in her speech, but I heard her say a word that I know is distinctly unparliamentary, and I think she may want to withdraw it. The word was F-A-R-T.
Ultimately, the parliamentarian ruled that if Rempel didn't want to apologize, she didn't have to. So there we have finally the legal precedent to an age-old question. When it comes to the offensiveness of fart, she who supplied it is able to deny it. In other crazy Canadian news, ranchers in British Columbia have noticed a spate of fence thefts. Huge chunks of wood picket fences are being absconded with. The reason? Home decorators going for that authentic lived-in look. We'll tell that to the cattle. I mean, this report says that the speed limit on Coquihalla Highway, south of Merritt, is 120 kilometers per hour, and the cows returning from the range typically weigh more than 500 kilograms. I don't know what any of those units of measurement mean, but I know this is not good. Cows are going to get hit without that fence. And the question is, when you steal a fence, can you turn it around and sell it on the black market? You know, can you fence a fence? Finally, we have a piece of not-so-crazy Canadian news. But if you want to sing the jingle, you can again. Okay, great. Let's rejoin Michelle Rempel, the one who said fart on the floor of Parliament, on a Tuesday, I believe. And don't worry, her party had her back. Conservative interim leader Rona Ambrose tweeted, "Way to go at Michelle Rempel. I'm with you on hashtag Team Fart, fighting for Alberta jobs." That's it. There you go. That's the way to own it and brand it. Hashtag Team Fart. But anyway, that was Tuesday. By Friday last week, the same Michelle Rempel was in Parliament taking a stance on a bill about transgendered rights. And she started off with a statement far less common for a politician to say than uttering an off-color word.
"In 2013, after review of this bill, I concluded that this bill would only amount to symbolic action for the trans community. I was wrong."
Now, half of the Conservative Party backed the bill this time around, and here is Rempel explaining why she changed her vote.
"I'm standing in the House of Commons. I'm a cisgendered woman. Only a few decades ago, as I stand here in pants, advocating for my community, as a divorced woman, as a woman without children, I think about how I would have been perceived and what my role as a gender in gender would have been. Decades ago, I wouldn't have had the right to stand here."
The bill would guarantee legal and human rights protection to transgender people across Canada, and it passed the House of Commons and now awaits a vote in the Senate. And this has been, except for the last one, which is a little bit inspiring, but mostly crazy, Canadian news. And that's it for today's show. We've elevated Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, to the top of the credits, but in return had to move two producers down. They are Mary Wilson and Chris Berube. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, is still in his normal place, though at night he sneaks to New Hampshire to collect seaweed. The gist, we have bitten off more than we could chew, meaning Andy Bowers' leg. Oomperu depru du peru, and thanks for listening.